Part 2. The Evolution of Leaking. Insiders know where the bodies are. Julian Assange. Chapter 2. The Cryptographers. Tim May stewed in his apartment complex's outdoor jacuzzi in Sunnyvale, California. He had recently split with his girlfriend, but the burly 6'1" bearded physicist wasn't the type to dwell on female troubles. His gray matter was plagued with a more vexing problem: the mystery of the failing semiconductors. In 1974, May had joined a small computer chip company called Intel. The little-known firm was gambling on using metal oxide semiconductors, or MOS, in its memory chips, instead of the bipolar transistors used in traditional chips from IBM or Fairchild Semiconductor. That new approach was designed to squeeze more tiny gates containing ones or zeros of information onto a single chip, and it had recently won the microprocessor Maverick an 8-figure contract from the AT&T division Western Electric to provide the memory chips in its Denver data center PBXs, the boxes that still serve as network hubs for phone systems inside of large companies. The deal was an enormous windfall for a 3,000-person firm competing with much larger chip giants. But it had hit a potentially fatal snag. Western Electric's PBXs were crashing frequently and unpredictably. Because the problem had arisen only after it switched to new chips, the AT&T execs put the blame squarely on Intel. And when Intel engineers were dragged in to check on the PBX malfunctions and monitor the PBX's memory for errors, they confessed. As often as every hour, a single bit would flip on their chips. One unit of data switching from a 1 to a 0 or vice versa, seemingly of its own accord, leading to maddeningly random software glitches. Intel's engineers tried every test they could think of to find the source of that bit flip, but they couldn't even reproduce the problem, much less solve it. They even hypothesized that the magnet from a janitor's floor buffer's motor might be causing the errors as it swept past the PBXs. The theory didn't pan out. As a task force of engineers was assigned to the problem, AT&T's patience was starting to wear thin. 25-year-old May wasn't meant to be working on the problem, but one of May's colleagues, knowing the young engineer had a background in particle physics, had stuck his head in May's office and passed on a new theory that none other than Intel founder Gordon Moore wanted May to check out. Perhaps cosmic rays, subatomic particles bombarding Earth from space at near-light speeds, could knock chips' electrons out of place, causing the same sort of problems that were now leading to AT&T's PBX debacle. May whipped out his trusty Hewlett-Packard calculator and did the math. Some quick operation showed that even at Denver's altitude, not enough cosmic rays could be reaching the chips to explain Western Electric's errors. The ray theory was bunk. But Moore's question had gotten May thinking. And as he basted in the hot tub that spring evening, he looked down at the granite walls of that outdoor tub and experienced his own bit flip of intuition. Granite and other stones, May knew, give off extremely low levels of radioactive alpha particles due to their hundredths of 1% thorium and uranium content. And Intel had recently switched its chip's casing to a new type of ceramic material to save a few extra bucks per chip. On an atomic scale, alpha particles are big and clumsy boulders that plow into objects' surfaces, compared to the cosmic rays that hit Earth from space. But perhaps the radiation necessary to knock those chips' data off kilter wasn't coming from the cosmos. Instead, May thought, what if it came from a source as close to the vulnerable computing jewels as May's skin to the granite hot tub wall at his back? Drying off and pulling out his calculator, he determined that an alpha particle would be 5 times the size necessary to affect the distinction between a 1 and a 0, as stored on one of AT&T's chips, corrupting a semiconductor's data storage like a tennis ball crammed into bathroom piping. The next day at Intel's lab, he put a handful of the chip's ceramic material into a radiation-measuring counter chamber, left it there for 24 hours, and measured the results. Sure enough, the material was throwing off so much radiation that it maxed out the chamber's meter. Later, he pulled the chunk of radioactive americium out of a smoke detector and attached it to the test chips with only a strip of masking tape in between, a barrier thick enough to stop the progress of any alpha particles. No errors. Then he stripped the tape away, and sure enough, the radiation reproduced AT&T's problem many thousands of times over in its silicon victim. He saw the problem plaguing Intel's chips laid out before him in all its radioactive simplicity. "When that chip lit up like fireflies," says May, "it was a peak moment in my life." Intel responded to May's breakthrough by creating a new chip design that used less radioactive materials and more shielding. The entire semiconductor industry, from IBM to Fujitsu, followed suit. An outstanding coup for an upstart like Intel. Even years later, the chip giant would hold up May's work as an example of the company's groundbreaking spirit from the start. Creative, innovative, brilliant, all of the above. Tim May had imagination, former Intel CEO Craig Barrett told a journalist 25 years later. He wasn't encumbered by history. He went off and did something wonderful. For May, nothing at Intel was ever quite so much fun again. His alpha particle glory earned him his own lab and several promotions. But Intel was growing from a gritty startup to a corporation full of middle managers and stovepiped divisions. May had no stomach for management, especially under the rise of the gruff Hungarian immigrant chief executive Andy Grove, where the bottom 10% of each division continually feared for its job. As the years went by, May occasionally performed a calculation with his well-worn HP calculator based on his stock options, Intel's ballooning share price, his cost of living, and projected interest. Unlike colleagues in Silicon Valley who spend their wealth on boats and beach homes, May lived a largely ascetic life, avoiding restaurants, skipping travel, and saving almost everything he made. By 1986, the results of May's arithmetic showed he had enough money for roughly the rest of his life without ever working again. In July 1986, 4 months after a critical performance review, he quit. At 34, May was retired, and he was altogether unsure what to do with the majority of his life that still lay ahead of him. But Intel's Barrett was right. May had imagination, and he wasn't encumbered by history. A few years later, he would list his new interests in the signature of his emails: anonymous networks, digital pseudonyms, reputations, information markets, black markets, collapse of governments. One spring afternoon in 2010, close to a year after the release of Bradley Manning's collateral murder video, I rented a Volkswagen in San Francisco and drove it south over the nearby hills and down California's treacherously winding Highway 17 to Santa Cruz, into a region that harbors two of the great figures in the subversive crypto history that led to WikiLeaks. One of those men was Tim May, but I had little hope of actually tracking down that controversial crypto anarchist and anonymity innovator. Several contacts had already warned me that he didn't take kindly to visits from journalists. One laughed at the mere idea of my trying to find him. A 2003 article I'd read in the German newspaper, Die Zeit, described rumors that May had become a long-bearded hermit, living in a well-fortified redoubt in the mountains. A WikiLeaks associate alluded to claymore mines planted in trees around May's home, a final line of defense should the jackboots finally come for him. I resigned myself to the conclusion that he had achieved the ultimate trick of untraceable anonymity, disappearing completely. Instead, I'm meeting with a different Santa Cruz crypto activist, one whose work also helped to spark a movement of anarchist code freaks, and to nearly land him in jail, Philip R. Zimmerman. When I step into Zimmerman's dining room, a few blocks from the city's rocky coastline, he's wearing a PRZ monogrammed dress shirt untucked over his round hobbit's torso and drinking tea out of a mug from the annual Black Hat Hacker Conference in Las Vegas. The trim-bearded, wide-featured, and perpetually grinning programmer takes great pleasure in handing me the NSA mug he bought in the gift shop of the Fort Meade Cryptology Museum. As we sit down, he offers a short commentary about how restaurants don't understand that handing someone a lukewarm cup of water and a tea bag isn't an acceptable way to serve Earl Grey. Then we wait for him to eat some microwave noodles before he's ready to begin the interview. "My brain will work better after I've eaten," he says slowly. When I start to ask him questions, he reminds me, still grinning, that he won't answer them until he's finished his lunch. It occurs to me that this is not a man who would have adjusted well to prison life. As we sit in silence, punctuated by the sound of noodle slurps, I peruse his shelves. One wall is covered in awards from civic organizations and privacy groups, the other with books on nuclear history, novels by Isaac Asimov and Neal Stephenson, and below them, a mass of cryptography textbooks. It's only when I mention one in particular, titled PGP, Source Code and Internals, that Zimmerman immediately sets aside his lunch and switches into war storytelling mode. "As soon as they decided to prosecute me," he says in a mischievous tone, "that book would have been Exhibit A in my defense. But we're getting ahead of ourselves." So now that I have Zimmerman's attention, I ask him to start at the beginning. And he begins with a different war story, the one about Dr. Daniel Ellsberg. One dusty 1987 morning in the middle of the Nevada desert, as Zimmerman remembers it, Ellsberg, Zimmerman, and a crowd of 430 protesters filed 2x2 through the gates of Nevada's most active nuclear test site, where waiting guards calmly fitted them with riot handcuffs, led them off to a nearby bus, and trucked them 40 miles to the tiny nearby town of Beatty to be detained by local police in a community center and then released. Ellsberg wore a suit, the better to illustrate with his arrest that even men who wear suits aren't above the law. Zimmerman abided by a similar principle. "I wanted to show that we weren't just a bunch of hippies protesting," he says in his slow Midwestern cadence. "The message was that we were respectable Americans just like anybody else, only willing to go to jail to stop the nuclear tests." For Zimmerman, the Nevada protest was the culmination of a decade of following Ellsberg's activist lead. Growing up in the era of the Pentagon Papers and Watergate, Zimmerman had been alarmed by the United States' insistence on maintaining the world's largest, most advanced stockpile of first-strike nuclear warheads. He'd been moved by Robert Scheer's essay, "With Enough Shovels," on the government's callous attitude toward nuclear war. Scheer quoted a high-level Pentagon official as saying that with enough shovels, every family in America could simply build their own nuclear bomb shelter by digging backyard trenches and covering them with the detached doors of their homes. Thinking of their newborn son, Zimmerman and his wife made plans to escape the doomed United States for New Zealand, one of the world's most strongly anti-nuclear nations. Still in the process of applying for immigration papers, Zimmerman and his wife had attended a nuclear weapons freeze campaign conference in Denver. The highlight of the event was a speech by Daniel Ellsberg himself. Ellsberg described the million-strong protest in the Vietnam moratorium of 1969. At the time, the press had reported that Nixon ignored the marches and watched a football game. In fact, Ellsberg told the Colorado crowd, Nixon had been wringing his hands in the White House Situation Room, looking at crowd estimates and aerial photography. Though they didn't know it at the time, Vietnam's grassroots activists had convinced President Nixon not to use nuclear weapons in the war. The conference's message of hope, and particularly Ellsberg's speech, swept away Zimmerman's pessimism. When he and his wife returned to Boulder, they had made up their mind. They would stay in the United States and fight. It was like I had been in an airplane that I knew was crashing, trying to get in the back seats to increase my chance of survival, he says. Instead, I decided to get into the cockpit. Zimmerman began inhaling books on atomic history, spending 40 hours a week at his job as a computer engineer, and another 40 educating himself on the nuclear age. Within a few months, he was teaching a class in military history at the Free University in Boulder and speaking out publicly against the Reagan administration's policies. In 1985, Gorbachev came to power and declared a unilateral moratorium on nuclear testing. Now, Zimmerman and his peacenik cohorts hoped, America's aggressive regimen of vaporizing cubic miles of dirt and rock with hydrogen bombs under the Nevada desert could finally end. But the nuclear tests continued unabated. Under pressure from his generals, Gorbachev warned in 1986 that if the United States exploded just one more nuclear weapon, the USSR would be forced to begin testing again too. And it was that one crucial nuclear warhead deep under the Nevada sands that brought Zimmerman, Ellsberg, and more than 400 others to Las Vegas, where they piled into buses bound for the desert. The Pentagon had bumped up its schedule and already exploded its underground bomb the day before. Over the next years, Gorbachev, not Reagan, would end the world's nuclear standoff with the dissolution of the USSR. But the protest had a different significance. Zimmerman's first experience with civil disobedience locked in his resolve to grapple with unjust authority. And although he didn't know it then, the unassuming geek was entering a new conflict where he, not his activist hero Ellsberg, would take center stage. As the Cold War was winding down, the crypto wars were about to begin. 10-year-old Tim May sat in his bedroom with the lights turned off. He held a jar-shaped device called a spintheroscope that came with his Gilbert chemistry set, essentially a can with a small piece of radioactive radium at one end, a lens at the other, and in the middle, a thin whitish screen of zinc sulfide. Zinc sulfide is a scintillator. When alpha particles hit its surface, it gives off light. So May allowed his eyes to adjust to the darkness of his room and then watched tiny radioactive asteroids flare into stars as they collided with the luminescent material at 33 million miles an hour. Science's ability to generate everyday miracles was a given in May's young life. His earliest memories are of his childhood in the early 1950s, growing up in a suburb of San Diego. 30 miles north was the Mount Palomar Observatory, with its world's largest telescope, and another short drive west led to the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Jules Verne's books fueled his scientist's imagination. Once he remembers looking out of the window at his family's ranch-style house and seeing a bizarre, smooth wing roar by, a plane without a fuselage. He later learned it was a Northrop prototype for the Air Force's stealth bomber. One of his neighbors, across his backyard fence, was an aerospace engineer who had worked on some of the first intercontinental ballistic missiles. And when the Soviets launched Sputnik, May remembers looking up with the old man in his backyard one night and watching Sputnik orbit overhead, an artifact of human power in the sky. Despite his glimpses of the wonders of science, May's upbringing wasn't all innocence and whimsy. Though May's father was a naval officer, he had first been an enlisted man in the South Pacific and drove a bulldozer in World War II. And May's father didn't spare him the grisly tales of war, how he had been ordered to use the machine to push sand over pillbox bunkers full of Japanese soldiers, burying them alive. After May's father was transferred and the family resettled in Washington, D.C., it was also May's father who encouraged his 12-year-old son to join the local gun club. They would shoot 22 rifles together, and May learned to feel comfortable carrying and soon owning weapons. Later in life, he would slowly accumulate more of them: a .22 revolver, a .357 Magnum, an AR-15 assault rifle, a Ruger, a pair of Sig Sauers, and many others that he declines to name. Just a few years after that move, May's father was transferred again, shipping out on the day of Kennedy's assassination to the town of Villefranche-sur-Mer on the French Riviera. It was a fantastical setting, with Jacques Cousteau's ship, the Calypso, often anchored in the harbor, and looming above the town the hill that Nietzsche climbed while writing Thus Spoke Zarathustra. A newcomer in a foreign country, May had few friends. As he would throughout his life, he replaced much of his social interaction with reading: physics, computers, chemistry, and science fiction, from Asimov to Bradbury. In the seventh grade, he put together a 100-page report on the design of atomic weapons in World War II, complete with explanations of the workings of nuclear fission, diagrams of how Fat Man and Little Boy's chain reactions were triggered, and the effects on their targets, including graphic pictures of Japanese burn victims from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. "It was clear to me then," he says, "I wanted to work in nuclear physics." When May's family returned to Washington, D.C., he was years ahead of his classmates in his autodidact's understanding of science. He won every high school science fair, with projects demonstrating the radio frequency emissions of ionized gases in magnetic fields and quantum tunneling. And in the summer of 1968, he discovered Ayn Rand. May read Rand's Atlas Shrugged as just another science fiction novel, but this one was about politics, not technology or science. The 1,000-page manifesto spoke to him about the hypocrisy of altruism and the exclusive virtue of selfishness. It explained in stark terms why anyone who seeks to oppose the profit motive and take from the rich to give to the poor is a moocher or a looter, and a temporary hurdle to human progress. And most resonant with the young physics wunderkind, Rand imagined a fantasy world, what the book calls Galt's Gulch, a hidden place in the mountains where the extraordinary and hyper-competent can escape the needless and regulatory clutches of the masses, a Shangri-La devoted to science, progress, and human greatness. In the novel's climactic monologue, the heroic John Galt explains to the world that its best thinkers and doers have disappeared to his elite haven. "Do not attempt to find us. We do not choose to be found," he says. "Do not cry that it is our duty to serve you. We do not recognize such duty. Do not cry that you need us. We do not consider need a claim. Do not cry that you own us. You don't. Do not beg us to return. We are on strike. We, the men of the mind." By the time May reached college, he had already stopped reading Rand, and says he would look back on her books as flawed and smug. But her ideas stuck with him. In the 1972 presidential campaign, May's first as a legal voter, he wrote in John Hospers, the first libertarian to make it onto some state's ballots. He would continue to vote libertarian for the next 40 years. Today, he still throws hints of her ideas, interpreted in their harshest tones, into his speech and writing. He speaks of the clueless 95%, the dirt people clamoring for more handouts, or predictions that, in the next decades, we're going to see a massive burn-off of useless eaters. "My political philosophy is to keep your hands off my stuff," he says. "Out of my files, out of my office, off what I eat, drink, and smoke. If people want to overdose, c'est la vie. Schadenfreude." May was accepted to MIT, Stanford, and Berkeley, but chose to attend the University of California at Santa Barbara after the provost of its honor school explained that he could take graduate-level classes as an undergrad. He arrived just as the late 60s revolution was in full swing. Anti-Vietnam War protesters burned down the Bank of America in the neighboring college town of Isla Vista. But May largely went about his work, graduated, and took a job beside his fellow physics geniuses at Intel. May's time at Intel was less a career than a few years' detour from his ideological wanderings. After his alpha particle victory and disillusionment with the world of business, he would retire and retreat from Silicon Valley, over the hills to his own personal Galt's Gulch, a two-story house a mile from the beach in Aptos, California, with only his cat, Nietzsche. In his new life of aimless intellectual exploration, May would walk down to the beach every day with a stack of business, science, and technology magazines, academic papers, and science fiction novels, and greedily consume them until the sun set. "I never had any interest in horseback riding, boating, hiking, or whatever it is people do," he says. "Instead, I just read and read and read." The young ex-physicist became a technical and non-technical intellectual omnivore, consuming science fiction and philosophy with equal literary gluttony. He read John Bruner's science fiction novel, The Shockwave Rider, about a world where identity is digitally defined, and one rebel group allows anyone to anonymously spill their secrets over the phone lines. He read Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game, with its pseudonymous characters Demosthenes and Locke, who are actually genius elementary school-age children influencing global politics on the internet with their untraceable ideas. He read James Bamford's The Puzzle Palace, a history of the National Security Agency and its shadowy work, and Werner Vinge's True Names, a novella about a cyberspace where hackers are elevated to gods, and their only weakness is the identity that ties them to their frail bodies. Soon, May discovered the Usenet, the Internet's nascent bulletin board system. He would wait until night to switch on his 1200 baud modem and log on, the better to save money on bandwidth and avoid the traffic jams that plagued the early information networks. It was slow and poor and primitive, but it opened up a new world, he said. I let my magazine subscriptions lapse. In 1987, May's fellow techno-libertarian Phil Salen came to him with an idea Salen had been turning over in his mind for years, a market for selling information. He would call it AMIX, the American Information Exchange. Long before eBay, Salen imagined an ethereal version of that auction system, where users could pay for answers to their queries or offer up packets of knowledge to the highest bidder. In later years, big-name technologists like Mitch Kaper and Esther Dyson would advise Salen on the project. But May says he immediately pointed out a fundamental flaw in his friend's vision. AMIX, he told Salen, would inevitably become a black market for stolen knowledge. Someone asks if anyone knows how to solve the charge buildup problem during ion implant of N-type wafers, May posits. How long before a guy who works for a chip firm offers to sell his company's tens of millions of dollars in research for $100,000? Salen countered that companies and government agencies would prevent their employees from accessing the market and selling out their secrets. But May had an intuitive sense that there was no way that such protections could stop the leaking of expensive information. Motivated individuals would find some way, any way, to anonymously access the site and spill the guts of the companies or government agencies that employ them. Then, as the idea rolled around the darker edges of May's imagination, he began to reconsider. Perhaps this concept of an information market could be quite interesting after all. Phil Zimmerman was born in 1954 in Camden, New Jersey, to alcoholic parents. His mother was a homemaker, and his father drove a cement truck. Their drinking meant that the family often struggled to pay rent, and Zimmerman remembers frequently moving out of houses in the middle of the night, many times leaving most of his childhood possessions behind them. The Zimmermans were homeless often enough that their father began to refer to the family car as the Buick Hotel. Before Zimmerman was 18, he says, he had attended 25 different schools. As a rootless kid, Zimmerman took refuge in a secret world of codes. When he was in the fourth grade, then living in Miami, he watched a Saturday morning show called M.T. Graves and the Dungeon. Every week it would pose a secret message and tell the audience that for just $2, they too could buy a decoder and unscramble the cipher. But Zimmerman, who rarely had $2 of allowance money to squander on such hobbies, cracked the code without the decoder. It turned out to be a simple substitution scheme. 1 for A, 2 for B, and so on. Intrigued by how easily he had outsmarted the show and obtained its $2 secrets, Zimmerman graduated to more complex codes. Before the age of 10, he had learned Morse code, semaphore, and Braille. It was around that time that the budding cryptanalyst discovered one of the most influential books of his young life, Herbert Zim's Codes and Secret Writing. Zim's codebook went deep enough into the hidden arts of cryptography to captivate Zimmerman for months with simple cryptanalysis, the science of decrypting codes without knowing the key. Fashioned his own encryption systems from scratch, and cloak-and-dagger craft like writing invisible messages with lemon juice or vinegar. The acid breaks down the paper's cellulose to sugar where the juice has been applied, so that it caramelizes and turns brown when heated with a light bulb. Using what he learned from Zim, Zimmerman would challenge a friend to create an encoded message, asking him to make the message as long as possible to make it harder. Then Zimmerman would use a simple frequency analysis to crack the cipher, counting the proportions of every letter in the encoded text and matching them up with a statistical frequency of letters in the English language to produce a solution in minutes. Zimmerman's cryptographic dreams always took a back seat to his greater ambition of becoming an astronomer. But when he left high school, Zimmerman faced a tough reality. He was several IQ points short of being a math savant. At Florida Atlantic University, hardly MIT, Zimmerman could never put his foot on the same intuitive grounding in multivariable calculus that he had found in the pleasant logic of codes. He found it, instead, in computer science classes. One of the first programs that Zimmerman wrote outside of class in his nascent coding career was a stab at implementing the simple cryptographic codes he'd loved since childhood. His first project, a digital version of one-time pads, one of cryptography's simplest encryption schemes and one that's theoretically unbreakable. One-time pads are a deceptively straightforward tool. Assume Alice wants to send Bob a message, Alice and Bob being the two stand-ins in every cryptographer's explanation of a theoretical scheme, and both have a copy of a pad with random numbers, 1 through 26. That list is the one-time pad, so-called because it's meant to be used for one message and then destroyed. Alice converts every letter in her message using the same A equals 1, B equals 2 substitution scheme that M.T. Graves and the Dungeon taught Zimmerman in elementary school. But then Alice goes down the list of numbers on her one-time pad, adding each number from the pad in order to every number from her substitutions and subtracting 26 from any number above 26. She sends the resulting gibberish, what cryptographers call ciphertext, to Bob. No one who intercepts those numbers can make any sense of them. But Bob uses his copy of the one-time pad to subtract the same series of random digits, adds 26 to any negative numbers, reverses the substitution scheme, and voila, reads the message in its original form, what cryptotypes call plain text. If the numbers on a one-time pad are truly random, and if it's used just one time, that simple scheme is mathematically proven to be impossible to crack. But those are significant ifs. As early as 1942, for instance, U.S. intelligence found that the Soviets were carelessly reusing one-time pads for communication with different countries, and analyzed the multiple examples of the scrambled text to find patterns that allowed them to remove the pad's random noise, breaking the ciphers. The digital one-time pad that Zimmerman programmed as a hobby project generated its random numbers with Fortran's random number generator. Never mind that Fortran actually used a pseudo-random number generator based on a math operation known as a linear congruential equation. Zimmerman thought he'd created an uncrackable encryption program before his senior year of college. It was very simple-minded crypto, but I believed it was fiendishly clever, Zimmerman says. A few years later, he would find that same scheme he had invented in the homework section of a textbook by Georgetown cryptography professor Dorothy Denning. The assignment, Zimmerman discovered to his embarrassment, was to break the code, and it was considered a relatively easy problem. Zimmerman, a good-natured and humble crypto devotee, took that intellectual blow in stride and lost none of his gusto for the science of scrambling data. And in 1977, he read an article in the Scientific American written by Martin Gardner that would change the course of his life as swiftly as Ellsberg's speech in Colorado. Gardner's article explained a revolutionary new breed of encryption called public key cryptography, and it solved a problem that had plagued cryptographers since the birth of codes: how to share secrets between two people who have never met. With traditional encryption, or what's known as private key or sometimes symmetric key cryptography, the individuals communicating must somehow both have the secret bit of data, known as the key, that locks and unlocks the encryption on their messages, just as a one-time pad can be added to or subtracted from a message to scramble or unscramble it. If Alice in New York wants to send a private message to Bob in London, she uses a private key to encrypt her message, and Bob uses the same key to decrypt it. But there's an inherent Achilles heel in that scheme. If Bob has never met Alice, how does Bob get Alice's key securely? She has to send it to him somehow. But they can't encrypt the message that carries the key. They come up against the same problem of how to send a key that decrypts that message. If Alice gives up and mails Bob an unencrypted key, on the other hand, any sinister man in the middle could intercept it, copy it, send it on its way, and then decode all their future messages. Unless Alice and Bob have already met in some dark alley and shared their key, private key encryption is hardly private at all. In fact, it's called private key encryption precisely because the key must be kept private, which is what makes actually using it so tough. Public key encryption, on the other hand, uses some mathematical tricks that vaporize that private key problem as thoroughly as a used one-time pad in a burn bag. In the public key cryptographic scheme, Alice doesn't need to use a private key to encrypt her message and then messenger a copy of the key to Bob. Instead, Bob performs some computational sleights of hand that generate two keys, one known as the public key and one as the private key. That public key isn't for decrypting secrets, it's only for encrypting them. And it has the unique, almost magical property: what's encrypted with that key can only be decrypted with Bob's private key. Suddenly, the conundrum of how Alice mails the private key to Bob disappears. Bob already has the private key, and he can send his public key, the key Alice needs to encrypt messages that only Bob can unlock, to Alice on a postcard from London to New York. The sinister man in the middle can read that postcard all he likes. Not only that, Bob posts his public key on his website, prints it on his business card, and even adds it to the signature of his email. In fact, Bob wants everyone to see the public key, because it's used for harmlessly scrambling secrets, not unscrambling them. Bob's private key, meanwhile, remains cozily stored on his hard drive and never has to be shipped across the Atlantic Ocean. Using Bob's widely available public key, Alice can now send Bob messages that only he can read. Mission accomplished. In his article, Gardner quoted a dictum from Edgar Allan Poe that human ingenuity cannot concoct a cipher which human ingenuity cannot resolve. Poe, in other words, believed no seemingly unbreakable cipher exists that can't be outsmarted by some other, cleverer cryptographer. But Poe had been proven wrong, Gardner wrote, by the implementation of public key encryption invented by three MIT scientists, what would come to be known as RSA. He concluded that the scheme was no less than potential proof that just such a practical, unbreakable form of encryption was possible. If MIT's cipher withstands cryptanalysts' attacks, as it seems almost certain it will, he wrote, Poe's dictum will be hard to defend in any form. By Gardner's calculation, cracking MIT's code would take about 40 quadrillion years. In fact, that was a few zeros too many. But even so, requiring somewhere between 20 and 40 times the age of humanity to crack meant the scheme remained fairly secure. Here was an invention as boundlessly powerful in its own way as the atomic bomb, but one that could shield dissidents instead of arming despots. All that was needed was a tool to bring public key encryption out of the realm of academics and spooks and into the hands of political troublemakers. Zimmerman, naturally, aimed to build it. Tim May read Martin Gardner's column the same year as Zimmerman, and its promise of unbreakable cryptography planted a seed deep in his science fiction-fueled imagination. I came to see encryption as a kind of force shield, where the energy to pierce it is more than the entire energy of the universe, May says in the hurried tone that he adopts when building towards something that excites him. It was a truly impenetrable bubble of privacy. The seed was still there in 1987 when May learned of Phil Salen's Amex information exchange plan. Salen would die of stomach cancer several years later, with Amex still unrealized. But May's obsessive mind never let go of the idea's subversive potential. If encryption could hide not only what was said, but who was saying it, he realized, that new flavor of secrecy could transform Salen's innocent information market into a guerrilla bazaar for buying, selling, and distributing all the world's secrets. With those inchoate thoughts of anonymous security breaches whispering in May's ear, he discovered the article whose ideas would finally make his crypto-libertarian dreams possible. It was a 1981 cover story in the journal Communications of the Association of Computing Machinery, already years old when May came upon it. Its author, David Chaum, a man who would come to be known as the prophet and godfather of digital anonymity. Chaum, a bearish, bearded, and white-maned academic, today heads a foundation devoted to secure voting and spent a decade pitching an anonymous transaction system called eCash. Despite signing up a few major banks, Chaum's cryptocurrency never quite caught on, a result of what some say is bad luck and others say was Chaum's overly controlling style of doing business, which may have quashed many of his company's attempts to find mainstream partnerships. But few in the computer security world doubt Chaum's sheer cryptographic brilliance. His patents range from physical locks to software security systems to anonymity and pseudonymity mechanisms that would secure his reputation as a computer science and information security powerhouse. Growing up and attending high school in an L.A. suburb, Chaum lived the rebellious life of a child who understands he is smarter than everyone he knows. He would show up for shop class and then play hooky the rest of the day, crossing town to sneak into computer science classes at UCLA. He ordered technical manuals for IBM and Fairchild semiconductor chipsets, and read them the way other kids read comic books. Since no engineers at tech firms would answer the questions of a teenage upstart, he even incorporated a shell company, Security Technology Corporation, and would use it as a front to call up firms and ask questions. I sensed that secrecy was this powerful mechanism, he says. I was fascinated by all of it. Dead drops, document security, burglar alarms, safes and vaults, locks, flaps and seals. Attending the University of California, San Diego in the early 70s, he breathed in the era's liberal sense of privacy and left-wing distrust of power. Chaum later left a four-year graduate fellowship at UCLA after just one quarter, disgusted with the program's military funding. Escaping to Berkeley, he focused on privacy and security features in computing, technologies that he argued were needed in a world where personal data would be ubiquitous and governments could mine it endlessly to track citizens. The department head at Berkeley, Manuel Blum, chastised Chom for taking such a focused view of his work's social goals. No scientist should attempt to predict the effects of his or her research, Blum warned. Chom responded with a dry thank you note in the introduction to his master's thesis, writing that the urge to prove his advisor wrong had been a central motivating factor in working on the paper. Later, as a professor at New York University and the University of California, Chom became obsessed with the problem of anonymity and its political implications. Neglecting his teaching for a year to pore over the entire literature of the social benefits and evils of protecting individuals' identity, works by thinkers like Thomas Kuhn and Lewis Mumford. He came out of that personal study surer than ever of his views on privacy, and it was soon after that he unleashed the article that would ignite an entire generation of crypto-focused anonymity advocates. It was titled Security Without Identification: Transaction Systems to Make Big Brother Obsolete. And to a reader like May, it must have seemed like one brilliant gift to the world of ideas after another. It began with a prescient description of how the digital world would allow surveillance and manipulation of normal people on a terrifying scale. New and serious dangers derive from computerized pattern recognition techniques. Even a small group using these and tapping into data gathered in everyday consumer transactions could secretly conduct mass surveillance, inferring individuals' lifestyles, activities, and associations, Chom wrote. The automation of payment and other consumer transactions is expanding these dangers to an unprecedented extent. Big Brother was no longer a character in 1984. Data tracking and surveillance was an immense societal problem looming just over the newly formed Internet's horizon. And then, over the next 15,000 relentlessly logical words, he offered a collection of semi-magical solutions, what he intended to be a comprehensive system for ensuring both the security of information from abuse and safeguarding civil liberties in a digital era. First, Chom outlined a method of using card computers, tiny machines that resembled credit card-sized calculators, as he described them. They would work as virtual wallets, holding a database of encrypted ID credentials and allowing users to spend and receive digital currencies, unique numbers cryptographically protected to prevent forgery or double spending of the same dollar or Deutschmark. Those crypto card computers would enable encryption transaction tricks that wouldn't be possible with mere cash. One such mathematical feat was what Chom called a blind signature. A typical cryptographic signature allows anyone to put their personal stamp on a message in a way that no one else can forge. Alice's signature can prove to Bob that a message to him came from Alice and only Alice. That concept had been proposed in the same 1976 paper that first suggested public key cryptography. In his paper, Chom took the idea a step further, showing a blind method by applying that unforgeable stamp. That is, now anyone could put their one-of-a-kind cryptographic signature on a chunk of encrypted data without ever decrypting its contents. What does that blind stamp matter? Because, as Chom described it, now a bank or store could put an unforgeable cryptographic signature on a piece of digital currency without being able to identify and trace each individual virtual coin. Consider the analogy of a money order in a carbon paper envelope. In Chom's system, someone could write a money order for $10, put it in a sealed cryptographic envelope, and take it to a bank that would remove $10 from the user's account and apply Chom's blind signature function to certify the money order without opening the carbon paper envelope, like a stamp that leaves its unforgeable signature on the paper inside. When the money order is spent, the user opens the envelope and hands it to the cashier, who checks the now visible signature on the money order with a bank that verifies the money order is real and worth $10. But because the order was sealed when the bank initially signed it, the financial institution can't put together who withdrew the currency and who finally received it. The result of all that sealing, stamping, and unsealing of envelopes, made effortless by Chom's card computers, would be a usable digital currency that can't be traced. Strike one against Big Brother. Chom intended his system of card computers and blind signatures to be used for more than money. A credentialing organization, say the Department of Motor Vehicles, could similarly put a blind stamp on the card computer's digital equivalent of a driver's license. The DMV wouldn't ever see the user's full identifying information, but a cop that pulls over a driver could be shown the signature to see that the driver was certified. The necessary credentials of daily life could be split from identification just as easily as financial transactions. Strike two for ubiquitous privacy. But Chom wanted to go beyond merely hiding the path of transactions or the personal details on credentials. He aimed to hide the source of any communications from any snoop. And the third major idea in his paper would be the most elegant blow yet against any would-be surveillance society. A compact method for a group of people to communicate without ever exposing who was doing the talking at any time. A force shield around the identity of a message's sender, even more powerful than the one that public key encryption provided for the content of that message. A foolproof cloak of anonymity. Chom called his privacy panacea the Dining Cryptographers Network, or DCNet. Imagine that three cryptographers are having dinner at a restaurant. At the end of the meal, no bill arrives. The three diners want to know if the check has been paid. But out of discretion, none wants to directly ask a waiter or either of their fellow diners if some generous friend among the three secretly paid it. So instead, they play a game. Two of the cryptographers flip a coin behind a menu to prevent the third from seeing whether it lands heads or tails. Then they go around the table, repeating the secret coin flip between each pair of cryptographers, always keeping the coin toss behind the menu to hide the result from the third friend. When all that coin flipping is done, each cryptographer gives a thumbs up or a thumbs down. Up if the results of the two coin tosses he or she saw were the same, and down if the results were different. But there's one important exception. If one of the three paid the bill, that magnanimous cryptographer flips his or her thumb in the opposite direction. If the total number of thumbs up is even or zero, everyone knows the bill has been paid, and no one's secret generosity has been violated. If it hasn't been paid, the sum of thumbs up will be odd, and the three stingy cryptographers can start arguing about which cheapskate's turn it is to pick up the check. Silly as that Dining Cryptographer's parlor game sounds, it represented a groundbreaking new idea that a group of people can communicate among themselves without ever identifying who's doing the talking. In more academic-focused papers, Chom would show that his DCNet system was capable of much more than anonymously determining whether a bill had been paid among three friends. Just as it could communicate a single binary yes or no question in the bill-paying case, it could be expanded to any number of people and any digital message. All computer communications are composed of ones and zeros, after all, whether it be a financial transaction or the launch codes for nuclear missiles. For an interloper like the NSA who watches the network and tries to locate a message's source, a DCNet isn't just hard to break. Chom wrote that it was unconditionally untraceable. He could mathematically prove that when a DCNet is properly implemented, there is no evidence whatsoever available to a snoop hoping to find the source of a payment, letter, or leak. In Chom's world, mathematically perfect anonymity was as real and achievable as a flipped coin behind a menu. Chom's paper set Tim May's mind racing. He immediately saw the idea's darkest implications, ones that Chom says he never intended to enable. One cryptographer would tell me that it was as if the crypto-anarchist movement Chom inspired came upon the advanced technology of an alien civilization and chose to take only the weapons. If financial transactions could be rigorously anonymous, May realized, they could fund anything, illegal drugs, assassinations, everyday transactions shielded from all taxes. If communications could be wholly split from identification, State secrets could be traded like pie recipes. Protected data havens could be created to store and allow anonymous access to illegal or taboo information. Massive troves of stolen financial data and intellectual property. Incriminating credit reports supposedly erased under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. The purposefully forgotten scientific results from horrific Nazi medical experiments. The epiphany came to May, he says, like a slow-motion version of his alpha particle discovery. Fundamentally, anything that could be done digitally could be done without oversight. For those who understood cryptography, Big Brother could be rendered a toothless nanny. May's imaginary force shield of cryptography could be extended beyond personal messages to entire communities. The libertarians' dream of an anarchic hideaway in the mountains or on a remote island was obsolete. Galt's Gulch was on the internet.